From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Lawmakers are sending a proposal to drastically reduce property taxes to the ballot in November. Opponents are worried about what it means for local services.
Who really benefits? Who pays the bills when the money runs out? Because someone always pays the bill.
Also this week, despite forecasts for a slightly less active hurricane season, experts say it's important not to get complacent.
You have to treat every hurricane as different because every storm is going to be different.
We'll also hear about a lawsuit accusing the government of failing to provide adequate medical care for immigrants in detention centers. And we'll learn about a program helping teen mothers continue their education. I'm Regan McCarthy, on the air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end of the week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. A proposal to drastically change property taxes will go before voters this November. WFSU's Tristan Wood reports the plan reduces taxes for most homeowners, but protects funds that go to schools.
Under the plan, homeowners whose primary home has a taxable value of $150,000 or less would pay property taxes only for schools starting next year. That value would go up to $250,000 in 2028. After that, the new homestead exemption would increase with inflation each year. Hialeah Gardens Republican Senator Brian Avila says local governments that depend on property taxes to provide services will need to rein in their spending.
I think what this will force is local government officials to actually really do right by the residents and really truthfully do the right thing in terms of looking at their budgets and prioritizing their spending, just like we do in the state of Florida.
Property tax revenues in the state have increased drastically in recent years as property values in Florida have skyrocketed. But opponents, including many Democrats, have concerns about the proposed cuts. They are worried the change could cause local governments such a loss of revenue that they would need to cut services. One of the critics is Orlando Democratic Senator LaVon Bracey Davis, who debated against the bill on the floor.
What services will be cut? Who really benefits? Who pays the bills when the money runs out? Because someone always pays the bill. And when the bill comes due, it won't be paid by Tallahassee. It will be paid by your city, your county, your neighborhood school, your library, your community.
Local governments would lose an estimated $8 billion annually by 2028 if the proposal is approved. Other critics, like Rich Templin with the Florida AFL-CIO, say those drastic cuts will give the state more power. He worries local governments will have to ask the state for funding each year to help cover necessities.
This is some real ranking member Escamani, Star Wars, Revenge of the Sith, like empire taking over kind of thing happening right now, where the state is going to assume massive control over all 67 of our counties and all of our municipalities. That is not conservative. That is not small government. That is not Republican. That is nothing that the majority has ever stood for. And yet that's what's happening right now.
Estimates suggest that rural or fiscally constrained counties will be impacted disproportionately. That's because tax revenue in these counties is already low, and more of the homes in those areas will fall closer to the $250,000 cap. Tallahassee Republican Senator Corey Simon, who represents 12 fiscally constrained rural counties, says several local government officials have voiced concerns to him. He voted for the amendment, saying he supports giving the choice to voters.
Listen, Taylor County is still digging out of the rubble of three hurricanes in 15 months. This is going to be painful if we don't come back and do the work that they've asked us to do. But first and foremost, we have to give them a voice. And that's what this bill is about. It's about giving the public a voice.
The proposal was championed by Governor Ron DeSantis and largely passed the Florida House and Senate along party lines. But for the proposal to become law, it will need support from 60% of Florida voters in November. I'm Tristan Wood.
Now that Florida lawmakers have given their okay to a proposed property tax reduction, it's up to the state's voters to weigh in. Randy Vuxta with WFSU's Rural News Service takes us to North Florida, where opinions on the issue are mixed.
Taylor County property appraiser Shauna Beach says the proposal will lead to most of the residents in her area keeping more money in their pockets.
A strong estimate here because we haven't ran the numbers since the new language just came out, but it would probably be around $1,500, up to $1,500.
Under the plan passed by lawmakers this month, the tax break people get on their primary residence, called a homestead exemption, will increase. If the proposal passes, most homeowners in the Beach's rural Big Bend community would only have to pay school-related taxes.
These citizens in our office on a daily basis and just saying, you know, inflation, fuel costs, insurance, property tax, it's hard to really even hold on to their homes. So it'll certainly help the burden that the property tax have put on these homesteaders.
Over on Florida's Panhandle in Gulf County, property appraiser Mitch Burke has concerns about what the plan would mean for local government budgets, especially as the increase phases in. By 2028, the homestead exemption is set to rise to $250,000.
On a county side, we're looking at a $1.5 million loss in revenue. For the following, for the 250 exemption, you're looking at almost $2.3 million in total.
Jackson County Chairman Jamie Westbrook says if the proposal is passed, he is worried that without the property tax revenue, some of the rural counties will have trouble funding emergency services. He says cuts will have to be made.
Well, we'll have trouble funding our programs and funding our people. And there's a pretty darn good bit of it. We have $125 million budget there, and it goes pretty darn quick.
Jackson County Fire Chief Charles Bruner says he's worried a reduction in property taxes could lead to cuts to fire services.
You know, a lot of people worry about their jobs. We're worried about, you know, cuts to different other departments in the county that may wear more than one hat.
Florida residents will have a chance to make their voice heard when this measure goes to ballots this November. For it to pass, it needs support from 60% of voters. I'm Randy Vuxta.
Hurricane season is officially here. Forecasters are calling for a slightly less active season this year. But officials say that doesn't make storm preparation any less important, since, as they say, it only takes one storm in our area for disaster to strike. Gina Jordan spoke with Leon County Director of Emergency Management Kevin Peters and Matt Cavell, Leon County's Head of Community Relations and Resilience, about the importance of being prepared.
Really, severe weather hazards have no real single season in Florida. We can have hazardous weather all 12 months. So being prepared is critical year long.
Yeah. What are the biggest concerns that you guys have for Leon County going into this hurricane season?
You know, one of the things that we hear people say is like, oh, I'm from Florida. I've lived here my whole life. I know hurricanes. And that can be a little bit of a dangerous attitude because you have to treat every hurricane as different because every storm is going to be different. So having all those preparedness things that we advocate, you know, having a family emergency plan, knowing what you're going to do during storm season, having a way to get emergency alerts and weather warnings all year long is important. And having your disaster supply kit, having supplies for each member of your family, everybody having their own kit. Those are the things that people need to have all year long. And they need to be thinking about as they go into hurricane season and what the next storm could bring, not what the last storms brought.
And to add to that, the shifting landscape too for insurance coverage for homeowners and for renters is very important for them to understand what their policy can cover. Some folks, since previous storms or even in the most recent year, their insurance policy provider has either changed the conditions by which they've renewed or they've even had to change policy providers in general because of that and changing landscape. So don't assume that you know your policy and know it before hurricane season.
That's a good point. I think a lot of people suddenly have new carriers. I mean, it's a big discussion with the legislature. So, yeah, I like that idea of everybody in the family has their own kit. Like, that could be fun for kids.
Yeah, right? We've seen a lot of success when going in with younger audiences and talking about the things that they would want if the power was off or the lights were off. And what were the things that would mean that your devices that you normally turn to just aren't available for you? Mm-hmm. What are the types of entertainment in a bucket, like coloring books or youth books or anything like that, that would still be able to entertain a crowd of folks, of young kids? And so they have that ownership. They can decorate the bucket. They can put things inside of it. And they can make it be a fun activity for the entire family.
Yeah.
The one thing I want to make sure people remember to put into their buckets, download a copy of your contacts from your cell phone. If you were to not be able to charge your phone, if something happens to your phone during disaster, that's a key thing. But kind of on the youth thing, our Billy the Bucket program is probably one of the most unique things that we're doing in the state. There is no mascot for youth preparedness and disasters. You know, the Forest Service has Smokey Bear, and I think everybody knows that, but there isn't an equivalent in disaster space. Yeah. So we're really pushing the Billy Bucket program, the youth education, trying to empower these young Floridians that are going to grow up in the state and teach them preparedness skills that'll last a lifetime.
That was Gina Jordan speaking with Leon County's Kevin Peters and Matt Cavell. To hear more of that conversation, you can check out our podcast, Speaking Of. It's summertime and it's hot and humid. Although we have had a couple cooler days thanks to some much-needed rain, that kind of temperature for June is becoming rare. WUSF's Jessica Mazzaros tells us what climatologists are predicting for the next few months.
First thing to note for this summer is an El Nino climate pattern could bump up the temperature. Meteorologist Shell Winkley with Climate Central says human-induced global warming is also heating things up.
We know that at the end of summer, our temperatures will likely be much warmer than what we expect them to be.
Since 1970, Tampa's summer temp has increased by 2.7 degrees, and in Sarasota, it's 2.8.
That may not sound like a lot, but think about your body. When your body warms 3 degrees, you're on the couch and you don't feel well. Essentially, our summers have a fever.
You now experience almost 50 extra days of above average temperatures in your summer. And right now, the Gulf is so warm, it's adding moisture into the air, which doesn't allow it to cool off. I'm Jessica Mazzaros in Tampa.
And speaking of the summer season, Lee County has recently become the first in the nation to release sterile mosquitoes by drone.
The district hopes the sterile males will mate with females to produce eggs that will not hatch. That should lower the number of the biting insects. Rachel Morreale is the manager of the sterile insect program. She says the drone will help her team distribute mosquitoes to treatment areas more effectively.
Having this drone means that we can actually put the mosquito places where they want to be, and we get a better, even spread of mosquitoes all around.
The drone has a release cassette specially built for the district's Skydio X10 model. The cassette can carry 35,000 mosquitoes. They can be released slowly as the drone flies over treatment areas. The Lee District says the drone is a major advancement in reducing the number of mosquitoes that can bother Southwest Floridians during the rainy season. I'm George Murillo.
Coming up on Capitol Report, immigrants who were held in Florida's alligator Alcatraz are part of a lawsuit after many say they didn't receive proper medical care while detained.
You may not have enough healthcare workforce at the site, but then there's also this systematic problem of having a lot more people in detention.
Florida is leading the country when it comes to the number of executions carried out. That's raising concerns for some.
It's supposed to be rare. It's supposed to be separate from everything else. It's not supposed to be commonplace.
And for teen mothers, finding a way forward can sometimes feel impossible. A Florida program aims to help chart a path to the future. Immigrant detainees in Florida and across at least 32 other states allege in court documents that the government is failing to provide them with adequate medical care. WGCU's Mark Garber reports.
The Department of Homeland Security reports 51 people died in detention since the start of President Donald Trump's second administration, with about one death per week this year. An investigation by the Associated Press and KFF Health News finds that people detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement are being denied access to doctors and medications for maladies ranging from dental pain to pregnancy to prostate cancer. Jose Antonio Segismundo was unable to see an oncologist for the cancer in his abdomen while detained for more than 7 months at the so-called Alligator Alcatraz and at Folkston D. Ray Ice Processing Center in Georgia. His wife, Maria Jose Gonzalez, said he didn't receive any treatment, even though she sent his medical records and explained his condition to officials at the Georgia facility. When his stomach pain erupted, often suddenly and intensely, she said, they gave him only Tylenol. Rhea Khan also complains that she could see her mother getting sicker without her meds. She, too, was given only Tylenol while at the California City Detention Facility.
Her medications were given intermittently. She got them, and then she didn't get them, and then they gave them to her, and then they tried to deport her, so they took it away again. They're giving people with high blood pressure just Tylenol for the headaches, because when you have high blood pressure, you get headaches. They're giving people Tylenol. Same thing, like someone took a fall, Tylenol. No actual medical attention.
According to Amy Zeidan, a physician and researcher who reviews detainees' medical charts, the Trump administration policies on immigration are to blame.
You may not have enough healthcare workforce at the site, but then there's also this systematic problem of having a lot more people in detention. So, you know, in some cases we have seen, you know, the number of individuals at detention center increased by 1,500. And in some of those facilities, they don't really have the capacity, the healthcare staff, to absorb that.
Zeidan adds that healthcare providers at detention centers are being called on to perform treatments that they are not necessarily qualified to do.
In many cases, what we see in records are registered nurses or nurses doing the job of what a physician or advanced practice provider would do. But when you're asked to do something that is a bit beyond your level of training, that's when things can go wrong.
Zeidan echoes the research reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association in April that ICE custody is deadlier than it has been in two decades.
I would be concerned if I was in a detention center and I had an emergency, if I had a chronic condition. Currently, in its existence, in its current form, is not safe. I don't think it was ever that safe, but specifically with just the sheer amount of people and the numbers.
KFF Health News and the Associated Press both asked the Department of Homeland Security for a response 6 days before publication of their findings, but it did not provide comment. Department of Homeland Security officials have said, quote, it is both policy and longstanding practice for aliens to receive timely and appropriate medical care from the moment they enter ICE custody. I'm Mark Garber.
Florida led the country in executions last year, putting more people to death than any other state. That's according to a new report by the global human rights advocacy group, Amnesty International. Craig Tocino is a veteran appellate lawyer and the director of the Miami Law Innocence Clinic. He opposes the death penalty and argues that Florida needs to slow down its unprecedented pace. WLRN's Sophia Zeran spoke with Tocino to discuss the legal and political shifts that allowed Florida to go from one execution 1 year to nearly 20 the next.
Amnesty International put out a report saying that overall, like across the world, executions have increased. And in the U.S., it was almost doubled. And a big part of that was Florida's contribution to that number. So in 2025, there were 19 executions.
Right.
So just off the bat, when you hear that last year there were 19 executions, what is the first thing that comes to mind when you hear that?
Sadness, outrage, shock. It's just the previous top amount that had been happened in Florida before 2003 was 8. And so you got to wonder why. There's been a concerted effort by the administration in the state of Florida to increase the types of cases that, I'll use air quotes, under qualify for the death penalty, and to increase the ability for the state to get a death verdict, starting from the, you know, the 8-4 non-unanimous jury verdict, which in my view is still unconstitutional. We're on pace for 20 this year. It's a level of execution pace that in 35 years of me practicing in criminal defense and having done a fair amount of capital post-conviction work, never seen anything like this. I find it really interesting and upsetting that we're increasing the pace of execution when Florida remains and has remained for a long time the state with the largest amount of exonerations from death row. Arguments in favor of the death penalty, one of the most frequent ones is deterrence. And then followed closely behind that is, you know, we need to have justice for the victims. Well, there's no evidence, absolutely none, that suggests the death penalty is a deterrent.
In order for the death penalty to be a deterrence, the person who's shooting has to go, oh, here's my gun. I'm pointing it at you. Oh, hang on a second. If I pull the trigger, I might get the death penalty. You know what? I better not. There's no evidence that that happens ever.
What do you think makes Florida stand out in this way? Like, why Florida as a place that did 19 executions last year, also as a place that had so many people that were proven innocent, that were on death row? What about Florida as like an exception in this case?
Florida's one of the very few, I think there's only one other case, one other state, I think it's Pennsylvania, that allows this decision to be made by the governor. Without the courts not involved, there's no, you know, other panel involved. This is just only by the governor, and that's what he's been doing. I think it's also the case in Pennsylvania, but they haven't executed anybody in Pennsylvania for at least a decade, maybe more. And it's not that we don't have a history of getting things wrong legislatively with the death penalty in Florida. You know, it was just in 2016 when Hearst versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court, invalidated the entire death penalty scheme in Florida. Then they reenacted it and made it a little bit better, added the unanimous verdict criteria in there. And then there was a change, and now we had to go back to this 8-4 non-unanimous jury verdict. And, you know, there's tons of jurisprudence and a couple of United States Supreme Court cases that say, a criminal case cannot have a non-unanimous jury verdict. You know, when you look back at older United States Supreme Court precedent, it's supposed to be an extreme sentence. It's supposed to be rare. It's supposed to be separate from everything else. It's not supposed to be commonplace.
That was Craig Tochino of the Miami Law Innocence Clinic speaking with WLRN's Sophia Zeran. Attorney General James Uthmeyer has officially filed a civil lawsuit against OpenAI and its founder, Sam Altman. In the filing, the Attorney General's office alleges the artificial intelligence company that owns ChatGPT has been negligent.
Sam Altman and ChatGPT have chosen the AI race over the safety and security of our kids. They have chosen profit over public safety. And we're not going to stand for it here in Florida. So we will hold them accountable.
Uthmeyer has been a loud voice against ChatGPT since investigators say logs show the accused gunman in the shooting that took place last year on Florida State University's campus asked the AI chatbot for advice on how to carry out the shooting. The attorney general is also currently conducting a criminal investigation into the platform. He says the company should have safety measures in place.
ChatGPT, this is one of the biggest corporations, the best at analyzing and programming data. How can they see somebody planning a murder over hours, days, or even weeks and not step in to fix it, not alert authorities about what credible evidence might be there?
Family members of one of the victims killed in the FSU shooting have filed their own lawsuit against OpenAI. A spokesperson for the company has said OpenAI is not responsible for the shooting and that safeguards are in place. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, for young mothers, balancing school and being a new parent can seem like a daunting task. On WGCU's Southwest Florida in Focus, culture and connections reporter Elizabeth Andarji learned about the Young Parents Education Program that aims to make sure teenage mothers have everything they need to build toward a better future.
All the teen mothers out here, I'm proud of them for what they're doing. And nothing's stopping them from walking the stage, nothing's stopping them from getting an education, nothing's stopping them from anything, what they want to be or what they want to do.
Michelle Hemingway knows what she's talking about. She was 19 when she got pregnant. Now, she's watching her own daughter go through it. Kalani DeMasso is 15, oldest sibling in her family, a single mom, and she had her daughter at 14. When she found out she was pregnant, her first task was breaking the news to mom.
I was thinking that she was going to kick me out. So I was scared to tell her.
Hemingway was shocked, angry at first, but she never left.
It was kind of rough, but I didn't want to break down as a parent. And then she had the baby and she'd say, I don't want the baby anymore, you know? And I wanted to be support her and be there for her as long as her family and everybody else to support her to show her it's going to be okay.
That support system is exactly what the Young Parents Education Program is built around. Students drop their babies off at the daycare center, newborns, toddlers, no age restriction, then head to classrooms on the other side of the building. There, teachers help guide through self-paced online coursework. The students still have to pass standardized tests for a diploma. Kimani Mallory is 18. Her son just turned one. Through a partnership with the trade school next door, she'll graduate with her diploma, then continue on to earn a welding certification.
I'm really excited to graduate because I had a point where I was very discouraged about school and I dropped out and I came back. So I'm really excited about graduating.
The program has also partnered with Harry Chapin Food Bank to create a pantry. In many ways, it reflects the philosophy behind the entire program. Remove as many barriers as possible so these young women can keep moving forward.
I mean, there's not much we can ask for that they don't do. We're pretty much spoiled. They give us anything we want. We have a pantry full of snacks and clothes and shoes, resources and stuff. It's pretty nice. I like it.
Brittany Vasquez is 16. Camilla is 7 months old. She's raising her alone.
I thought I was going to have a partner, but then turns out it wasn't the person I thought. It was a person that had a two-face, you can say. But I have my mom, I had my parents. My dad did get deported. I only have my mom right now.
Oh. It's a baby.
She transferred here not knowing what to expect.
Leaving a lot of friends. It was hard. Part of it is leaving my teachers, because I had some teachers that were very close. I could tell them anything, and they would just help me. But it was hard to separate from them. But I got here, and I have better teachers, the ones that will help me, talk to me about it, be a part of my journey.
In Lee County, where teen birth rates already outpace the state and the nation, these young mothers are still here, still showing up, babies in the next room, diplomas within reach, and for the first time, a program that's not asking them to choose between the two.
It may feel like you're alone, but you're really not. You have friends to count on. If you come here, you're going to have teachers, you will have diapers, wipes, you have help. You will have hope. Don't ever quit on yourself.
I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Tom Flanagan, Tristan Wood, and Randy Vuxta. Thanks also to Mark Garber, Elizabeth Andarji, and Sophia Zaran. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. We hope you'll join us again next week, on air and online, for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.